But let's take a few moments now to prepare ourselves in quiet. There's one golden thread that we find all the way through the many, many sources that we search into to find the unfoldment of ideas that we think of as new thought. And this one golden thread is the relationship of the individual with the infinite, with mind, with the whole. And so we're just going to begin tonight by realizing our oneness, realizing a sense of relationship with the allness of mind, realizing the flow of life, of love, of substance, of intelligence, of peace, poise, coming easily from within ourselves and giving rise in us to a security, a stability, a confidence, physical wholeness, and a sense of well-being in all of our relationships. And that which flows into us may be and often is referred to as the presence of God. It is that of God which is present, dynamically present, as a guiding, directing, healing influence. We acknowledge this. We give thanks for it. Amen. So much for that. Now let's take a look at another source of what we've called antecedents of the new insight in truth. Last week we considered roots in philosophy, and we saw how the concept of the allness of mind has prevailed since the dawn of recorded thought. This evening we're going to consider another stream that has led to, at least has had one influence on modern new thought. When we use the term psychology, there may be a fixed view suggesting psychoanalysis, Freudianism, behaviorism, abnormal psychology, and so forth. Quite often people say, well, psychology says, da-da-da-da. Teachers sometimes make this kind of a statement. Now, I always think this is about like saying religion says, and there are thousands of religions and religious views, and there are many, many, many variations of psychology. So it's a generalization that means nothing to say psychology says so-and-so. I guess it's just like a person needing some authority for his view. He says, well, I read it in a book somewhere, and that makes it true. And of course, you find books on any subject. You know, it's in the book, so it must be true. Well, psychology then, as a term, means many things, and there are many branches, and certainly most, if not all, of these branches are very sincere efforts to deal with the human mind, looking at it from different perspectives. But we're thinking of psychology in its broadest possible context, first of all, dealing with man's age-old interest in the mind. And it may surprise you that there has been a great interest in the study of mind for thousands of years. And we're dealing also with psychology in terms of the evolution of the idea of mind cure. And again, it may surprise you that mind cure has been around for a long time. Psychology at one time was the science of the psyche or the soul. This is where psychology, as we know it today, began. The word psychology means the science or knowledge of the soul. The mind was considered as a distinct reality, not the brain, but the mind. But after long, wavering years of uncertainty, and in the recent times, because of the desire on the part of psychologists to be accepted as a profession and to thus move their philosophies into what they would like to accept as an exact science, there has been a turning away from the study of the mind or the psyche or the soul, which is beyond any credible inspection, and therefore there has been an emphasis purely upon the many facets and functions of the human brain. The mind as a real entity was either defined out of existence or ignored as scientifically unapproachable, simply because it wasn't directly observable from the outside. And so psychology has tended to become, and again I'm using the term loosely, certain branches of psychology, or perhaps in modern sense the largest field of psychology, has tended to become completely physicalistic. A concept of a mechanical brain guiding a physical body with all of its many functions and with no room for anything extra-physical. But before we consider this and how it's happened, let's kind of look backwards in time. Now, I'm certainly not trying to give any sort of a history of psychology. I'm not equipped to do this, and I'm sure there may be one or two or 10 or 20 of you here who may be psychologists by interest or by profession, and you may question some of the kind of outlines that I deal with. And I will say immediately that these are inferences that I have drawn from my own research and therefore are not at all that which in any way purports to be a history of psychology. The name psyche, of which the word psychology is formed, was used by the ancient Greeks to describe the human soul, and the soul to them was symbolized with the image of a butterfly. Now, if you think of the metamorphosis of the worm chrysalis butterfly, you have one of those imponderable, baffling, mystical, magical, delightful processes that I don't suppose anybody ever completely understands. A complete disintegration of the former worm into liquid or living water, reduced to elements from which a new structure comes forth. And in the worm, or the caterpillar, there is no foreshadowing of the butterfly at all. And in the butterfly, there remains absolutely no remnants of the worm or the caterpillar. And yet there it is. So this, I think, gives some indication of what was implied by using the butterfly as a symbol of the psyche or the soul. The soul, therefore, is the key to the potential of man. And we may not be aware of that, but from way back into earliest times, there were many seers and mystics and teachers and philosophers who had a great belief and conviction relative to this potential of the soul or the inner man in fulfilling outward growth and leading toward perfection. So the soul is the key to the potential of man. And the miracle of growth and overcoming, the belief that man can transcend his limitations and unfold his God self, has prevailed through myths and teachings for ages on end. From the earliest times, there's been a belief that there is an urge in human nature which impels man to seek in many endless ways for something that he never fully comprehends, but believes to be a supreme reality. And somehow he has always known that he can never be happy until he attains the fulfillment of this intangible something. which is rather complicated, but then religions have been complicated and philosophies have been complicated. Everything that lives aims at the fulfilling of its innate pattern. Every man living has had a restless discontent that keeps him ever seeking, searching, rising, not in competition with other people, but in achieving superiority over his former self, as the ancient Orientals might have put it. So this is an insight that was held by many of the early antecedents of modern psychology. They were later drowned out by ecclesiastical religion when this phase of learning and of philosophy had to go underground. Now, in the earliest periods of history, there were actually wise men who made a study, serious study, of the nature of the human mind. And I say in early periods, I mean we see records of this back in at least the 6th century B.C. One such was Heraclitus, who was quite involved in the study of the human mind and the human personality, and he said that the human personality has no boundaries, that the mind of man is involved in an all-encompassing mind. Perhaps he did not refer to this as we might think of it today, but it would seem to say that we live in what we would call divine mind, infinite mind, and thus man living in infinite mind has a resource constantly involved in him, which is his own potentiality. And I think this is a concept that it seems to be articulated by Carl Jung in more recent times, who makes a statement that is one of the most exciting comments that I've heard from people involved in various fields of psychology. He refers to the subconscious mind. It is likely that he is referring to it in a much broader sense than that which we think of the subconscious mind as being the memory mind that contains a memory of past and of the experiences of our lives and so forth. Because he seems to also imply in this a dimension which Charles Fillmore would call the superconscious mind, or that which opens out to a larger dimension. And he says that within this subconscious mind, there is contained not only all the knowledge that it has gathered during the life of the individual, but that it contains all the wisdom of the ages, all that has ever been expressed and experienced by man anywhere, and all that ever will be unfolded by man in all the ages to come. That's rather interesting, and I think it obviously is a statement that comes out of sort of an intuitive awareness of this thing that Heraclitus is talking about way back in the 6th century B.C., that the human personality has no boundaries. But we find in Plato's Republic, the classic work of Plato back in 380 B.C., that Plato recognized the influence of the mind and the emotions upon physical health. Socrates related to Plato the story of a charm which Socrates had obtained from a physician who, in giving it to him, had advised him, and these are the words that we get directly from Plato's Republic, and they sound very much like something that would be expressed today in defense of psychosomatic medicine or mental science or many of the various approaches to this field today. It says, the cure of a part should not be attempted without the treatment of the whole, and also that no attempt should be made to cure the body without the soul, and therefore, if the head and the body are to be well, you must begin by curing the mind. That is the first thing. And the great error of our day is in the treatment of the human body is that physicians separate the soul from the body. Now, it's rather interesting, 380 B.C., and we think that in New Thought today, we just started the idea of mental cure. Now, it could be said that the phenomena of mind cure, of faith healing, of psychotherapy, if you will, can be found throughout the ages in various shapes and forms, at least by inference, if not directly. For instance, in 600 B.C., we get this little couplet or song from Solon. The smallest hurts sometimes increase and rage more than all art of physic can assuage, sometimes the fury of the worst disease the hand by gentle stroking will appease. And of course, this seems to imply sort of the laying on of hands or the magic healing touch, all sorts of concepts relating to vibrations and so forth, all the things which healers, religious and non-religious, psychic and psychological and metaphysical, have seemed to imply or have worked with, and again, going all the way back to 600 B.C. In early time, there was an emphasis on a mind process that today we might call intuition. Education was not so much putting ideas in, but drawing forth what would be called the wisdom of the gods. For instance, Aesculapius, the Greek physician, and who was probably the founder of the first hospital of all the ages, used to train his disciples, who were medical doctors, or what passed for them in those days, first of all, by acquainting them with all the knowledge of what was called physique, or the science of the physical part of life, and then he would train them in the art of meditation, always thus that they would be still and let the wisdom of the gods reveal the mysteries that would be required. In other words, that they would seek for intuitive guidance in making what today they would call diagnoses. And this goes way back before Christ, obviously. Rather interesting. Now, this is the facet of the antecedents of new thought, the idea of intuition, and many ramifications of it that we will deal with next week under the Transcendentalists, of which Ralph Waldo Emerson is more or less the classic representative. In early times, the wisdom of the world was always in the hands of the priest scientists. This is a phenomenon that we may not always be aware of, and I think it's something that we must make clear as we go along to understand some of the things that have happened. The technological skill, for instance, of the priesthood of ancient Egypt was amazing. When you consider the temples and the pyramids and the irrigation systems that were conducted and so forth, and especially when you contrast those that were done by the clergy or by the religious representatives and by the military. Because military methods and means and armaments were very primitive. But yet at this time, the scientist clergy, as you will, if we can use this term, were capable of some tremendous engineering feats. And this is the way it has always been, at least up to the Middle Ages. Education and science was very close related. All of the sciences were, and the methods of research and the development of chemistry and of materia medica and all these things actually came out of early studies under the aegis of whatever passed for religion. And this goes way back into primitive times, where the tribal medicine men or whatever were always the ones that were involved in what passed for science. The interesting thing is that a crisis came in the Middle Ages when the church, under the influence of several rather dictatorial leaders and popes and so forth, made a definite attempt to curb what sometimes was referred to as analytical intellectualism. And this was considered a dangerous threat. Now, this had always been something of a problem to religionists in an authoritarian sense. And so there was a split created between the scientist and the cleric. And most of the outspoken clergy who were a part of the new concepts, and many who were not clergy but who were scientists on the outside, who were very outspoken in their beliefs and refused to retract them, most of them, as we've discussed even last week, wound up on the fiery end of a stick. But this tended then to drive scientific inquiry and philosophy and the kind of ideas that have led through the ages to the development of what in recent times has been called psychology into what could be called analytical materialism. In other words, it was a total reaction, pulling entirely away from anything religious, from any relationship to God or the wisdom of the gods or the intuitive flow and so forth. And with the exception of the sort of recrudescence of this in what we call Neoplatonism that we discussed last week, and which comes to full fount in the transcendentalism that we'll discuss next week, there was a total absence of any spiritual sense or any awareness of the psyche or the soul during this time outside of the narrow confines of the church. So the ideal of this spiritual dimension of man, with the exception of a very few, was driven underground and in many cases almost totally destroyed. But the interesting thing is that in the bubbling forth of this awareness in later times in Europe, that what we know today as the field of psychiatry and psychology and psychoanalysis and so forth, with all of its many variations, that it has a common origin, at least in terms of one of the influences upon New Thought, with what we think of as New Thought today, with the ideas that we call the New Insight in Truth, coming from a common fount. And this is a point that I want us to look at today, because while the church was condemning the intellectual approach to life, and thus burning all the bridges between the world of science, there were those who simply could not turn their back on the science of the mind or the soul. And the idea, as Fillmore puts it, that the mind is the connecting link between God and man, was too deeply ingrained in the consciousness of some persons. So there were a number of different ways in which this concept found its way to the surface, and some of them, as we look today, were ludicrous, primitive, and kind of weird. Experiments that were conducted in an unusual way outside of the formal church, and mostly even outside the acceptable fields of science, because the breach was very wide at this time. One such person that we'd like to look at is the Swiss savant with a rather weird name, at least from a Western orientation or from an American orientation. His name was Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. With a name like that, I think you'd want to run for cover. And I guess he did, because he referred to himself under the name that we remember him by, Paracelsus. Paracelsus was Theophrastus Bombastus von Hohenheim. In the year 1493 to 1541 was the period of his life. Now, he's a very important figure, even though what he was about seems kind of weird. And you might say, what has this got to do with psychology or metaphysics? He was a pioneer experimenter in the powers of magnetic attractions. He believed that he had uncovered the hidden power of nature, and inadvertently, he did open a new horizon of search. But he used a magnet to heal disease. He touched off a wave that continued for actually several hundred years in Europe, which was referred to as the cult of the magnet. And they did some strange things, often with actual great big magnets that they held before people, and they did it publicly and privately and with all sorts of flourishes and so forth, and there were many variations. He held that the impurities in the physical system were not physical but more psychical in nature, and that by this magnetic pull, which was applied in various ways, there was a method of drawing out the impurities of the system. Now later, a Jesuit priest sort of carried this concept a little farther and almost to a little more extreme ridiculous point when he ground up magnetic lodestones and had the patient swallow the powdered stone. And then he applied a poultice of iron filings over the diseased part. And his assumption was that when he held a magnet to the poultice, that he attracted the iron filings and the lodestone fragments in the stomach, and thus drawing out of the body the afflictions. And there were remarkable cures, which is kind of interesting, but probably tells a little bit more about the believability of the human consciousness and the act of faith than the science involved, but there was actually something involved here, strangely enough, that led to some interesting discoveries of the mind. The cult of the magnet reached its height in the 18th century when a man by the name of Franz Mesmer, have you ever heard of mesmerism? Those of you who had any background in Christian Science know that Mesmer was pilloried by Mary Baker Eddy, indirectly at least, through the term MAM, malicious animal magnetism. Well, Franz Mesmer sought his medical degree. In 1773, he presented the faculty of medicine at the University of Vienna with his thesis on the influence of the stars and planets as curative powers. Now, here was a very interesting period, and as a matter of fact, carrying over out of this period are a number of words which we still use today, and quite often the imprint of the movements of history can be seen in the development of words. Some of the words we use today that came out of this period of Mesmer's and those who sort of played with some of the concepts he worked with is the word lunatic, mercurial, saturnine, jovial, martial, and so forth. All of these coming out of the influence of the planets, the moon, the sun, and so forth. Now, it was Mesmer's theory that the moon and the sun and the stars all affected the human organism through an invisible fluid, which he termed animal magnetism. Now, certainly it's possible, if not likely, that any cures he effected, and we're told there were many, they were largely due to the power of suggestion over the patients. But eventually, Mesmer made a great discovery. He discovered that the magnet itself was not necessary. And he embellished his theory by transferring the power of this animal magnetism of his own body. And he claimed that he was able to affect the vital forces that flowed through another person's body and thus cure them of disease. Now, Mesmer was an interesting character. Obviously, in his early times, he was a sincere researcher. Like so many leaders of cults, and his work did become very cultish, he began to play God. He was influenced by the tremendous popularity he received, and he was obviously influenced a great deal by money. He became very popular. He was rejected totally by the scientific community as a charlatan, though actually the King of France offered him a king's ransom if he would disclose the power, the secret of his powers, which he refused to do. Thousands of invalids sought him out, and he had tremendous miraculous cures, supposedly. And eventually, in order to handle the droves of people, he became involved in a mass production that had all the appearances of a great church service. And as we are told now by the accounts that are given, and I've read a number of them, with a great showman's flourish, with a throng of people sitting breathlessly waiting, almost like waiting for any modern evangelist or guru or anything else, and perhaps with whatever could be engineered with lighting or whatever was available in those days, and with whatever music might be available, there was a great emotion that was built up. And then out into the room or onto the platform would come Mesmer, attired in a lilac robe, with a Merlin's pointed cap on his head, and with a magician's wand in his hand. And he would bounce around the auditorium, and he would go up to people and he'd touch them with the wand and he would say, "Move out, get up, you're healed." And various other terms in French, of course, that would be commands to the person to be totally free from whatever ills that possessed them. I mean, it sounded very much like a kind of modern healing revival that one could see in these days. And again, as I say, like many modern leaders of various kinds of cults, he began to do a lot of the things that obviously were somewhat at least influenced by the desire for power and for money. He magnetized water and sold it to his patients. He magnetized their clothes for a fee. A patient had only to carry a magnetized charm purchased from him and he could never fall ill, supposedly. In other words, you could almost see, and I say this without in any way tending to be disparaging, but looking at the phenomena of these things, of some of the modern healers, for instance, who sell healing cloths and so forth and various other appurtenances relative to the healing process. Obviously, this is a phenomenon that's been around for a good while. Now, you might say, what has all this got to do with metaphysics, with the science of the mind, or with the evolution of either psychology or New Thought? Well, it's rather interesting, I believe, and this is a point, observation, which I suppose I make of my own volition and without very much support, but it's a conclusion that I have drawn, and I think there is at least some merit in it, that beginning with Mesmer, there is a branching out of two seemingly diverse schools of thought or streams of activity and consciousness. One of them, beginning with mesmerism, eventually going through the discovery of hypnotism and suggestion and a study of the mind itself and psychoanalysis and Freud and Adler and Jung and as we go down to this modern aspect of psychology. And the other, which we will give some thought to 2 weeks off when we study Phineas Parker's Quimby, beginning with Mesmer and going through a number of other influences and eventually coming to Quimby in America. And like it or not, and I know some of our CS friends are very unhappy that I even refer to it in this way, flowing through Christian Science and Mary Baker Eddy and many of the other early New Thoughters in New England down to, again, the influence of mental science upon this new insight in truth. Now, obviously, we're not going to deal with the part that goes through Quimby. We'll deal with that 2 weeks off. But in the former stream, you see, the students of Mesmer, and he did have students, serious-minded students, because though the man had all the appearances of a charlatan, yet something was involved. There was something there. It's like the person who goes to make a study of one of the modern evangelical healers and he sees all the showmanship and all the so-called catchers and the falling and all the things that are involved and yet says, but the fact is there's a phenomena here. Something happens. And so he looks into it from a more scientific point of view. So there were those who were studying Mesmer and what was happening. And one of his students was a Marquis de Puysegur, who gave a great deal of thought and research and experimentation, and he found that Mesmer was actually creating a kind of artificial somnambulism, which is a term that later gave rise to hypnotism. And thus, in this hypnotic state, by suggestion, the person accepted into his subconsciousness the idea that he could be healed. Now, here we find surfacing in vague and sometimes unrelated ways the idea of the subconscious aspect of man and the subconscious mind. Now, the subconscious mind is certainly a word that you run into constantly in the study of metaphysics or New Thought in a modern sense. There's no knowing when it ever started in the form in which we know it today or how it has evolved. You can trace it back to many, many ways. But certainly we see it surfacing during this period of the studies that seem to come out of this phenomena of Mesmer, which again came out of the magnet, the cult of the magnet. Certainly all these early experimenters were involved with the process of mind and with a kind of mind power, which though in the beginning they were not aware of and couldn't quite understand, yet it was a phenomena that they were dealing with. William James, American psychologist who had his own personal healing experience in the mind cure field, and this went a long way to changing his direction. He started out as a medical doctor. He was a professor of physiology and anatomy in the university and also a professor of philosophy and the founder of the School of Pragmatism in philosophy and a very great scholar in these fields. Because of a great deal of confusion bordering on what probably was a mental breakdown and the question as a researcher and what was happening in himself and how it could best be altered or healed, In showing certainly the open-mindedness of the man, he gave some serious thought to what was going on in his day that passed for this kind of mind cure phenomena that was around, and made a serious study of it, and became convinced that many of the aspects of this phenomena were very valid, and thereby through his concepts and his work, injected into the further evolution of psychology a new dimension, which has had a great deal to do with some of the variations of psychology. That's getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but actually, in his Varieties of Religious Experience, William James says, "The discovery of the subconscious mind is the most important step that has occurred in psychology, opening the way to an unprecedented use in Protestant countries of mind cure." Now, actually, before we bring William James into the story in a ideological way, we want to deal with another dimension of this flow that started out of Mesmer and came down through to Peisiger and various other researchers, and probably also would include the evolution of hypnotism, which is normally attributed to a mass Scottish researcher by the name of Braid, but probably has antecedents to that. We come to a person that most of us do remember, if we've been around a while, and that is Coué, Emil Coué, 1857 to 1926. Coué touched off a movement that swept across Europe like a prairie fire. Since he brought healing by psychological means, it seemed to give a practical dimension to some of the more complicated ideals of Freud. Now, Coué made a great discovery. He discovered that the patient did not need the suggestive therapy applied by another, as in hypnosis. He felt that within the patient himself was the power, that he did not need a trance state so that direct access to the subconscious could be obtained by simply suggesting to himself certain concepts and beliefs. So an idea, if repeated again and again in a confident voice by the person, would sink into his own subconscious mind with a healing influence on the patient. And Coué had his patients repeat those now famous words, "Every day and every way I'm getting better and better and better." And this was a concept that made the rounds and it became a cliche, really, because it was so widely used and talked about. And again, tremendous results are attributed to Coué-ism. At one time, he had hundreds of people lined up outside of his door waiting for appointments, and he would take them one after another. Now, unlike Mesmer, there was no ostentation or paraphernalia with Coué. He wasn't a showman. He didn't even try to explain his theory to his patients. It was a very simple process. He just had them practice the formula. And he injected into this concept some things which have become standard ideals in the New Thought movement of Christian Science, Religious Science, Divine Science, Unity, and whatever you want to consider. First of all, there must be no negatives. A person must never talk about his illness. He must not even name the illness, because this would tend to fix it in his consciousness and make it the more difficult to be healed. There must be no future tense in talking about the healing possibility. It was not enough to believe that I will be healed. I know that I will be healed. This was not enough to Coué, because this would put the healing idea and concept in the future, and it would actually block out the immediate flow of the process, which he felt was there. In other words, he said that the person must accept the healing possibility right now. And so, for instance, to a lumbago patient, he would have a person say over and over, "My back is easier now. I am able with greater and greater ease to bend my back. I am free from any pain. Pain is gone immediately. It's gone. And every moment it's gone. And I am free from all of the limitations of my lumbago." And this is the kind of thing he did, sort of a suggestive process that he had the people deal with, and again, tremendous results. Certainly, indicating a kind of a forerunner of some of the techniques and practices that prevail in metaphysics today in many variations. Well, we could not really go very far in considering the evolution of psychology as an influence upon the mind cure thinking of many today, and certainly an influence upon New Thought, without dealing with Freud. I hesitate to get too involved in Freud, because Freud is one that you could get into and lose your way, and a lot of people have lost their way in Freud. Freud went through many periods, but I think through Freud there was a tendency toward dealing, probing into the subconscious mind, dealing with memories and parasitic mental forms buried beneath the surface outside of the primary fields of consciousness. But in this psychoanalysis period that was touched off by Freud was a almost 180 degree turn away from the science of the soul, where the early antecedents of psychology began. A loss of the sense of spirit, of divine mind, of intuition, and so forth, and a dealing with human consciousness as a cesspool of various aberrations. Now, I hesitate to even refer to Freud too much, because Freud was a great influence and a great pioneer in the study of various forms of abnormal psychology, and certainly should not today be criticized just because today there is an awareness that there is a further evolution that is necessary. Both Adler and Jung, students of Freud, began a turn back again to some sort of a acknowledgement of the science of the soul. Jung especially gave somewhat of an acceptance to the idea of man and his relationship to the spiritual origins of life. William James, then, through a personal experience that we said of mind cure, brought a new influence into the field of psychology, recognizing the dimension of the spirit in the individual. While Freud dealt with the mind in terms of the repressions of all of the distortions and the limitations of human consciousness, William James took another approach. He said there is actually more life in our total soul than we're aware of at any time. And abundant living depends on keeping the doors open to this deeper dimension of the self. And he insisted that a variety of what might be called problem-solving processes go on unconsciously all the time within the subconsciousness of man. James introduced a concept, perhaps inadvertently, but one which obviously had been very helpful to him, which has been a basis of a whole phase of metaphysical studies. And it was the simple idea, act as if. If the unhappy person would simply act as if he were happy, he will soon find happiness a reality. If a person were to act as if he were a successful person, he would gradually begin to be successful in his relationships. Dorothea Brandy, I think, made the statement in Modern Times of act as if it were impossible to fail. Now, this has been an approach, this act as if approach, that has been picked up by modern New Thought and metaphysics and utilized, I believe, to an excess as a personal observation. But it has been influenced, certainly, by the William James concept. Today, the evolution of psychology has made a long turn back again to the spiritual quest in non-religious terms. And again, I must be very clear in my approach that when I say psychology, I'm not talking about all psychology. I'm not talking about the mainstream of psychology. I'm talking about fringes that continue to gain momentum and to become larger bodies within the field of psychology. For instance, perhaps Jung touched off a movement of interest in the depth processes of man, dealing with man in a whole sense. Ira Progoff today, who is, many of you know Ira Progoff here in New York City, who's considered a leading authority in the field of depth psychology. Progoff makes a statement which I think is rather interesting, that illness or neurosis is not the result of repression, as Freud contended, but it is basically the frustration of potentiality. and that the key to therapy is the reactivation of the process of growth. That there is within man that urge, that force for unfoldment and for growth and for releasement of the finer potentialities of his nature. And when there is any kind of a problem, mental, physical, environmental, or whatever, that there is some kind of a distortion, frustration of this process. And thereby, the key to the therapist then is to try to reactivate this process. Now, this is a total turn away from the Freudian concept, though obviously it draws upon a lot of the influences and the research of Freud. Jan Christian Smuts set forth the idea that he refers to as holism, which is an emphasis of the whole person, which goes way, way back to the days of Plato and long before him, but which is a resurgence in the modern emphasis of psychology upon this idea of treating the person as a whole person, knowing that he has this dynamic wholeness as a potential within his life. Now, actually, this emphasis in the whole field of psychology has created a swing back again toward the science of the soul. So that I think Ira Prograf talks about this in his book, The Death and Rebirth, or The Birth and Death and Rebirth. I forget the exact title of psychology. Of how psychology began actually as a spiritual quest and turned totally away from it and then gradually is coming back to it again. And so today we have fields, for instance, the whole general field that is referred to as transpersonal psychology, and then there is a field of psychosynthesis, which probably was set forth by the Italian Assagioli. There are various fields in this area that are dealing with the ideal of the one, of the whole person. The transpersonal self that remains aloof from the various involvements, the various roles we play, or the various masks we wear. I mention this because this somewhat is identified with some of the things we're going to be dealing with in our retreat this weekend and that we'll be talking about on Sunday. In other words, it deals with being aware of ourself as a distinct individual with the ability then to choose between being strong or being weak, or being sick or being well. But this kind of brings us up to date in terms of the flow of psychology. And out of this flow, there have been many influences upon the New Thought concepts that so many of us have been delighted in and helped by. A stream of thought that I believe very strongly came through, strangely enough, this very weird period of the cult of the magnet and of Franz Mesmer and mesmerism. Again, that could be debated, and I'm not going to take the time now to get into any extensive debate on it because I feel that it would certainly be a waste of time. Because actually, in the long run, what we're really interested in is an understanding of the insights of truth and seeking simply to broaden the base of the movement as we know it or the truth ideas as we deal with them so that there at least is a sense of a little greater credibility, a little greater academic acceptability, a little greater awareness that certainly there's nothing new in New Thought. And as I said, next week we'll kind of get involved in the work of the transcendentalists, notably Ralph Waldo Emerson. Well, I'd like to invite you right now to join with me for a moment in a simple little exercise which I think can help us to understand something that probably was the root of psychology and probably indicates the most progressive wing of psychology right today without even thinking of it as being New Thought or metaphysics. So let's take a moment now to get still. And I would like you to, for a moment, just get the sense that you are here in this place, that you are experiencing things around you, you're hearing sights and sounds, and your mind is responding to words and verbalisms, and the emotions perhaps are moving in various ways according to preconditioning. But there is that of you here that is aloof from all of this. There is that of you, again, which some of our folks might call the transpersonal self or the transcendent self, which is more than this physical body, which is more than this intellectual mind, which is more than this emotional part of your nature. So get the sense for a moment of sitting at the center of these various parts of yourself, knowing that certainly you have a vital experience in your body. You make constructive use of your emotions, and you were very much involved in the processes of reasoning and intellectual knowledge. But in every case, you are more than this. And just the simple awareness of yourself at this point you begin to experience a confidence leading toward the fringes of mastery. For you know that your body then is your servant. Your emotions are yours to use and employ in communication. Your mind is yours to think through. And thus, in this consciousness, you are standing on the very threshold of the ability to adjust and heal the body, to regulate and control the emotions, and to discipline your thoughts and the functions of your mind. Now just for a moment, be grateful for that illustration and acknowledge that the idea, the concept,